Welcome to the Law is Cool podcast. My name is Omar Haredi, and I will be your host for this episode. Devin Johnston, who has been hosting the Law is Cool podcast in the recent months, is currently articling, as have most of the team here at Law is Cool, seeing how bulk of our contributors joined the site and started law school in 2007. So we're always looking for new people to take over the site from us, including the podcast. And please do contact us at admin@lawiscool.com if you're interested. I will note that Devin recently received the Israel Aspert Award presented by the University of Manitoba Students Union Local 103 of the Canadian Federation of Students, specifically for his activities in broadcasting and journalism, which included his blogging and podcasting activities. In this episode of Law is Cool, we're going to talk to Christopher Brett of BLG, who's going to speak to us about climbing a mountain and how that ties into some of the pro bono work that he's doing. So I'm here today with Christopher Brett, who's a partner at Bordner Ladner Gervais in their Toronto offices. Thank you for speaking with us today.
I'm delighted to speak to you. You can call me Chris.
Pleasure to meet you, Chris, and pleasure to have you here on our podcast. Now, the reason why we're speaking to Chris is because Bordner Ladner Gervais, or BLG, has an initiative where they're going to be doing some fundraising for some population, for some children, I believe it is, in Tanzania. And as part of this initiative, they're doing a climb of the largest mountain in Africa, Mount Kilimanjaro.
That's right. It's a charity climb. The organization that we're raising money for is called CODE. And CODE is an acronym for Canadian Organization for Development Through Education. It works in a number of different African countries, primarily on children and women's literacy. Mount Kilimanjaro is the highest mountain in Africa. It's like 19,500 feet or so. And we have a couple of programs in Kilimanjaro. The one in particular that I'd like to talk to you a bit about is called the Children's Book Project.
Please do tell me more about that.
Well, the Children's Book Project is a very innovative project. What they do is they work in a bunch of schools in the poorest part of Tanzania, where kids are have a very difficult time getting to school at all. And part of getting kids to learn to read is getting stories that speak to their experience. So rather than sending books over from North America that, you know, aren't really all that relevant to someone who's growing up in a mud hut in Tanzania, the kids in the schools make up their own stories, and they take the best of those stories and they publish them in a local language, Swahili, and they use local illustrators. So you get Tanzanian artists who actually do the pictures for these books, and they're published in Tanzania. So this has all sorts of great things in terms of developing a literate environment. You've got kids that are excited because they're reading about stories that they themselves have made up. You've got Tanzanian artists who are being used to illustrate the books. And then you have Tanzanian publishers who are actually getting income from a program that's being funded by Canada. And the results of the program have been tremendous. What they've seen are the kids that go to primary school in the areas that they used to work on, less than 30% used to go from primary school to secondary school. And when this program was introduced, that figure went up to 60 or 70 of the people went out. The program has been so successful that it actually won a UNESCO Literacy Award. UNESCO is a United Nations agency that looks at these kind of things. So we're very excited about it.
How did BLG get involved in this project? Was that your own initiative?
BLG has a program it's a domestic program. Mm-hmm. It's called Reads to Kids. And what happens is BLG lawyers actually go out to inner city neighborhoods and read in the schools at the primary level. So we have a commitment to that. The CODE aspect came from me. I have been a longtime supporter of CODE. I was the chair of the board for 3 years. And the first time I did this in 2006, I was turning 50. So my idea of having a midlife crisis was to, you know, go climb Kilimanjaro. And I thought it'd be a good thing to do to see if I could turn it into a fundraiser, because CODE has programs in Tanzania. So that's how it came about, and the firm has been tremendous in supporting him.
That's great. You don't know this, Chris, but my mother is actually from Tanzania.
Oh, really?
Although my parents met in Canada, both of them have climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Wow.
But my mother has something over my father because she actually did it twice.
Well, this July, I'm going to catch up with your mom.
There you go. So I want you to tell me, first of all, what was your first experience like in terms of climbing Kilimanjaro? And how did you encourage or inspire your partners here at this firm to also want to join the project?
Let me talk first about the first climb. When I did the first climb, we had seven people that came on the climb, three of whom were from BLG. Mostly people come on the climb because it's kind of an adventure that people sound kind of interesting. But once I introduce them to CODE, they get engaged and they become interested in the fundraising aspect of it. So I had to pick a route to climb Kilimanjaro that was going to be doable by a guy called George Anderson, who was, you know, George was in his late 50s when he came on the first climb.
Okay.
And, you know, George was not a marathon runner. And Kilimanjaro is not a technical climb, so you don't need ropes and pulleys and so forth. Basically, it's a hike, but it's a high altitude hike. So part of climbing the mountain is to do it gradually so you can adapt to the altitude. The way the climb worked was that we were going to take 8 days to get to the summit.
Okay.
And it's quite neat because Kilimanjaro is basically right on the equator. So when you start the climb at the park gates at about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, you're in a tropical jungle. The first night you camp, you're still in the jungle. And the next night, you go from about 9,000 feet up to about 11,500 or so. Now you're out of the jungle, you're into what they call the moorland. So it's, you know, it's not a jungle, it's kind of like scrub forest type mm-hmm. thing. Day three, you're up to 13,000 feet, and now you're into kind of a savanna-like area, like grasslands and so forth. Day four, you're up to 15,000 feet. Now you're kind of in an alpine desert, so not much vegetation, kind of rocky. You can see ice sometimes in the crevices and so forth. Next day, you go down to 13,000. Part of the climatizing is you go high one day, and then the next day you come a little bit lower. And then the sixth day, then you're back up to about 16,000 feet. The toughest day of the climb, you go from 16,000 feet up to 18,000 feet, 200, which is basically in the crater. Okay. Kilimanjaro is like a big old volcano, so there's a crater up top.
Uh-huh.
And you camp in the crater, and then the next morning you climb up to the high point on the crater rim, which is the summit.
They don't have snow there anymore, though, do they?
There is. The snow is receding, but trust me. I'll tell you a story. It's okay. It's funny. When you camp in the crater, you camp on the north side of the crater because Kilimanjaro is in the southern hemisphere. And so you get more sunlight on the north side. On the south side, there's a huge ice field, huge glaciers. And this is like, you know, 200-300-foot wall of ice. And the evening we camped there was really cold. It goes down to, with altitude, because the air is thin, it can be quite warm during the day, but as soon as the sun set, it gets quite cold. Part of acclimatization is you drink a lot of water. So what that means is that, you know, sometimes in the middle of the night, you just have to go. And what that means is, when I was in the crater, it was maybe 2:30 or 3 in the morning. You know, I get out of my sleeping bag, and I put on my parka, and I put on my hiking boots, and I, you know, go outside, and it's cold. And I'm, you know, doing my business. But the night that we happened to be there was a beautiful, clear night. And you can see why they put telescopes at altitude, because the stars feel like they're so close you can almost reach out and grab them.
Wow.
And there was a full moon. We just happened to be there when there was a full moon, and the moon was like the spotlight on this huge glacier. And you could see this ice kind of shimmering away in the distance. And so I'm out there doing my business, and I'd woken my wife up, and she kind of yelled out at me, "How is it out there?" And I said, "It's cold as hell, but it's beautiful." So it gives you an idea that yeah. They're still at the top. There's still lots of ice.
That's good to know. That's definitely good to know. I'm sure my parents would love to hear that as well.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it was a very it's a very rigorous journey as well. So how did you encourage, like, when you came back to Toronto and you told this story to other people in the law firm? I can't imagine there were people there waving their hands saying, "I want to be the next one to go."
I think that the fact, you know, Kilimanjaro was, because of Hemingway's book and stuff, it kind of sits in a lot of people's imaginations. You know, your parents went and climbed it. And so a lot of people say it's kind of interesting, and then they say, "Yeah, but is it doable?" And the great thing about Kilimanjaro is that it is doable by someone who is in kind of average physical condition as long as they go at it slowly. Yeah. So a lot of people, when they go to climb the mountain, they take something called the Coca-Cola route,
okay.
which is, it's called the Coca-Cola route because there's huts on the route. But it's a very difficult for people to actually succeed using the route because you start off at 6,000 feet, you go to 10,000 feet on the first day, 16,000 feet on the second day, you go to sleep on the second day and you get up at midnight and you try and go to the summit, you know, hiking through the night so you get there at sunrise. Less than 40% of the people actually make it. Whereas the route that we took, which is a much more gradual route, over 95% of the people actually are successful.
Okay.
So on the first climb, all seven people actually made it, which was great. And so I can say to people like you, Armour, you want to come on the climb? I think a pretty good chance you're going to make it, as long as you do what the guides say, which is pole pole, which is Swahili for slowly.
So on this climb, then, who's coming with you? I understand there's about three or four other partners?
We have 13 people altogether, okay. including five from BLG.
Okay.
So we have Sean Weir, who's our national managing partner, Bill Carter, who's a partner in our health law group, Mike Smith, who does insurance and tort liability here in Toronto, and then a woman from our Vancouver office, Shelley Monroe, who's a real estate partner. So those are the people coming from BLG.
So really a whole spread of different areas of law as well.
Yeah, and from different offices, not just mm-hmm. Toronto, but from Vancouver as well.
Yeah, that's great. And do you find that the experience has some team-building qualities as well? Do you find that if you work closely, you know, through this climb, you make it to the top, and then you come back down, you come back to your law offices, and you have a greater sense of collegiality?
Absolutely. After the first climb, we had a one-year reunion out at our place, and you know, we're all talking stories and, you know, looking at all the pictures and reliving the experience. So, yeah, it is, you know, whenever you get out of the office and, you know, BlackBerries don't work on Kilimanjaro, so you're basically, you know, you're going to bed pretty, you know, when the sun goes down, you don't stay up too late and you get up when the sun comes up and you spend a lot of time. And parts of it are tough. And, you know, so like coming through that with people together, you do bond a lot, and it's an experience that, it's what I tell people, is an experience of a lifetime. It's something, you know, like your parents are telling you, they'll probably be telling your kids too, Omar, about,
sure.
you know.
I think the best part about this is that you're actually doing this to help the people there as well, so,
right.
you know, there is some personal development, but you're also giving back to the communities that are there in that region, so I think that's absolutely wonderful.
And it's
see.
Been very successful, actually. The first climb, we raised almost $110,000, and CODE, because its programs have been so successful, that every dollar we raise gets matched 3-1 by CETA, the Canadian International Development Agency. So what that meant, the first climb raised almost $450,000, and we're still working on fundraising. We're almost up to $110,000 now, and we're hoping that we'll raise $125,000 so that we can, you know, raise $500,000. That sounds like a nice round figure.
And so people that are here in Canada, if they wanted to contribute to this fundraising effort, would
right.
there be a way for them to do that?
Yes. You can go to CODE's website. It's codecan.org. And there's a, once you get to the website, you'll see there's a climb for CODE symbol there. Click on that. It'll take you to the climb. You can pick whichever climber you want to sponsor, and away you go.
Okay, so one more time, the names of the people from BLG, just in case people are looking to sponsor those people.
So Sean Weir, who's our national managing partner, Bill Carter, who's in the health law group, Michael Smith here in Toronto, and Shelley Monroe in Vancouver.
And, of course, yourself as well,
Chris Brett.
So look for those names, and we'll include a link to that site as well in our show. As you said, sometimes you got to go. And on that note, I think we're going to end it. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for coming to speak to me, Omar.